This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for September 2012. I'm Don Scher, senior editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Lindsay Garbutt, editorial assistant of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from poets in the current issue.
This month, we're going to hear work from Deborah Paredes.
Sweet meat and brine, a taste I must acquire.
Frederick Seidel.
It makes me think of James Joyce. You hear his oyerish voice.
Then we'll talk with A.E. Stallings about how poets in Greece are responding to the collapse of the Greek economy.
Even the political protests are chanted in verse.
Also in the September issue, we have poems by Jane Hirschfield, Billy Collins, Mary Carr, and others, as well as an essay on Philip Larkin by William Logan. Lindsay, this is the first time you've been on the podcast, but you probably know, like our listeners do, that this is when we read a poem from the issue that we particularly liked. So what is it that strikes you from the issue this time?
Well, there are a lot of great poems in this issue, but I'm going to go with one of the two by Dana Levin. I'm going to go with the first one, which is called My Sentence. Spring wind with its train of spoons, kidney bean-shaped pools, Floridian humus, cicadas with their electric appliance hum, cricket pulse of dusk under the pixelate gold of the trees, fall's finish, snow's white afterlife, death's breath finishing the monologue, phenomena the most beautiful girl. You carved the word because you craved the world.
You know, the poem begins with an M-dash, as we call it in the biz. That's a weird thing to do, especially in a poem called My Sentence. If it's a sentence, it's a weird sentence. I don't know if you have any feelings about what this sentence is trying to say.
It ends with an M-dash, too, so it's not even really a full sentence. It kind of sounds to me like it was almost a workshop project, like name all four seasons in one sentence and make it a poem. But that is how it goes. It starts with the spring and then the summer with kidney bean-shaped pools and late summer with cicadas and goes on to the fall and winter and ends with death's breath.
Yeah, the last line is italicized, carved the word because you craved the world, and the sort of moving around of letters in that sort of, it's more than a pun, though it works on a pun, but there's something interesting about that word carved because it has like a V in it. The letters in this line do what they look like. The V sort of carves something. It looks, that last line, like it's carved into the poem. This poem, My Sentence, is carved out of what may be some larger meditation.
Right.
And it has to do with that carving and craving. But who knows? It's mysterious.
It is very mysterious.
There's a poem I really like in the issue by James Longenbach. And this one's called Opus Posthumus. And he reads his poems in a very charming way, but I'll have to read it the way I can. It goes like this. When I painted, everybody saw. When I played piano, everybody heard. I ate your raspberries. The sign, no trespassing, applied to me. Now the hemlocks have grown higher than the house. There's moss on my stoop, a little mildew in the shower, but you've never seen my shower. I can undress by the window. I can sleep in the barn. The sky, which is cloudy, suits the earth to which it belongs. It's got a kind of privacy. In a sense, the ultimate privacy is when you leave behind a body of work and you're just gone and nobody can bother you. But it seems very wry and funny. When I painted, everybody saw. When I played piano, everybody heard. There's something about art that works against privacy. So it's sort of the workings of your kind of inner mind and emotions. And then everybody sort of sees the result. That little bit about the shower is lovely, too. It's sort of when you wonder about whether somebody's going to be intimate with you. You know, you might clean your shower a little better, but then this person has never seen it and stuff. And he's in the middle of nowhere and can undress by the window, sleep in the barn. That's real privacy. But then it's in a poem that thousands of people read.
And it seems like such a direct poem. But then the two instances of you and your really confused me. Is that you, the reader?
Yeah.
I've never seen a shower, obviously, but but whose raspberries are those?
Yeah, he's trespassing. But in a sort of genial way.
Right,
doesn't
right.
Doesn't seem like you're
you
going to put the guy in jail for it. And then to up the ante, it's supposed to be some kind of opus posthumus. This is something left behind. So it's a really lovely poem. And the ending is, you know, one of those things that good poets like James Longenbach can really do, where it's just an ending that feels like a real ending. The sky, which is cloudy, suits the earth to which it belongs. Everything seems in its place after all. This is the first appearance of Deborah Paredes in poetry. Paredes is the author of This Side of Skin, a collection of her poetry, and a critical study, Selenidad, Selena, Latinos, and the Performance of Memory.
Paredes is a professor at the University of Texas in Austin, and she's a co-founder of Canto Mundo, a national organization for Latina and Latino poets.
In the September issue, we have two of her poems.
They both, I think, engage in some way with disaster, I think, at least along the edges of them, if not explicitly in the center. But I think they were also just very much a part of the kinds of things that often draw me. You know, women in the midst of disaster, probably. I think you can find quite a bit of my work.
The first poem we're going to hear is called The Gulf, 1987. The Gulf is the Gulf of Mexico, which is not far from where Paredes grew up.
And though the year in the title has nothing to do with the various hurricanes and oil spills that periodically afflict the Gulf states, those disasters seem to lurk between the lines of this unrhymed sonnet. Here's Deborah Paredes reading The Gulf, 1987.
The day upturned, flooded with sunlight, not a single cloud. I squint into the glare, cautious even then of bright emptiness. We sit under shade, Thea Lucia showing me how white folks dine, the high life. I'm about to try my first oyster, Thea spending her winnings from the slots on a whole dozen, the glistening valves wet and private as a cheek's other side, broken open before us. Don't be shy. Take it all in at once. Flesh and sea grit, sweet meat and brine, a taste I must acquire. In every split shell, the coast's silhouette, bodies floating in what was once their home.
This is an amazing poem to me because it starts out doing something that we feel is very familiar to us. I mean, literally, you know, it's a memory of a family sharing things together. She's about to try her first oyster, and Tia Lucia is spending her winnings on the oysters. And it's a lovely little image of this event. But then at the end there,
flesh and sea grit, sweet meat and brine, a taste I must acquire. In every split shell, the coast's silhouette, bodies floating in what was once their home.
You know, it's the oyster, but of course what comes to mind is all the stuff that happens in the tragedy of meteorological disasters that increasingly seem to afflict the Gulf, the bodies floating in what once was their home. It's this sustenance, which is what the poem's about, but also disaster. And of course it succeeds so brilliantly too because it has the brilliant image of the coast silhouette in every split shell, which I think is one of those gifts a poem gives us. Mm-hmm. You know, it would never have come to mind before. And, you know, I think when readers see the poem, they'll never look at an oyster same way again because of the poem.
And I think that last line is so surprising the first time you read it, the violence in it. But when you go back, the glistening valves wet and private as a cheek's other side, broken open before us. I mean, there's violence there too, and that kind of prepares you in a way you don't realize until you get to the end.
There really is. The embodiment of appetite and disaster is what's so striking. Well, let's hear another poem from Deborah Paredes. This one's from a series of poems she wrote about Lot's wife.
Lot's wife, of course, was the one who turned into a pillar of salt when she looked back at the city of Sodom as it was being destroyed.
Deborah Paredes told us that she was interested in the idea of looking back in memory, partly because her Aunt Lucia, the same Tia Lucia from the poem we just heard, is suffering from Alzheimer's. She also told us why she wrote it as a villanelle.
I think that the villanelle really serves the kind of instructive poem well because of its kind of repetitive, obsessive energy. You know, it's good for giving directions.
Here's Deborah Paredes reading Wife's Instruction Manual.
When the forsaken city starts to burn, after the men and children have fled, stand still, silent as prey, and slowly turn back. Behold the curse. Stay and mourn the collapsing doorways, the unbroken bread in the forsaken city starting to burn. Don't flinch. Don't join in. Resist the righteous scurry, and instead stand still, silent as prey. Slowly turn your thoughts away from escape. The iron gates unlatched, the responsibilities shed. When the forsaken city starts to burn, surrender to your calling. Show concern for those who remain. Come to a dead standstill. Silent as prey, slowly turn into something essential. Learn the names of the fallen. Refuse to run ahead when the forsaken city starts to burn. Stand still and silent. Pray. Return.
One of the great gifts a poem can give us is when it reinvents or redeems a form. You know, there are so many bad villanelles in the world. And here, what is so lovely is the texture and tone of it. Overcome the repetitions that we associate the form with, you know, sometimes villanelles are kind of relentless. And the relentlessness here comes in what the poem is telling us rather than in the sounds. But it's also a sturdy and rueful poem.
Don't flinch. Don't join in. Resist the righteous scurry, and instead stand still, silent as prey.
Those monosyllables grab the reader of this poem, and like the poem before, these are poems that are written in the face of disaster, and they have sort of an utter calm lucidity, which is what they teach us. It's all unexpected.
When I learned the story of Lot's wife, it seemed like it was such a female problem that you would want to turn back and look back at something. And because it's telling you that you should do that, I don't know, I found it very encouraging to say that you're turning into something essential rather than turning into salt.
Yeah.
It's very redeeming, I think.
Yeah. It's not only redeeming the form, it's redeeming the whole biblical story.
Mm-hmm.
Learn the names of the fallen. Refuse to run ahead when the forsaken city starts to burn. Stand still and silent. Pray. Return.
The rhythms of it, too. You know, you can just feel the sort of toes growing into the ground. You know, it's a poem about standing ground. Again, completely unexpected. Frederick Seidel is still the bad boy of contemporary American poetry. His poetic persona as a Ducati-loving, fine wine-drinking lover of young and beautiful women is undiminished by the poet's 76 years.
And so is his power to offend certain precincts of the poetry world. He has long enjoyed tweaking the politically correct, and in the process, he has frequently been accused of sexism and misogyny.
Well, he's also one of the grimly funniest poets around. We have six of his poems in the September issue, which should give a good idea of Seidel's range. He was recorded reading three of them. First, a very short one called Snow.
Snow is what it does. It falls, and it stays, and it goes. It melts, and it is here somewhere. We all will get there.
That, to me, even the way he reads it, it's just right out of Philip Larkin. All those monosyllabic things that Larkin contended with, like work, days. This is a fantastic updating of that stuff. Snow. How do you write a new poem about snow called Snow? And of all the people in the world of poetry, Seidel has done it. Well, now let's hear a longer poem. There's nothing we can say by way of introduction except that the language and opinions expressed are solely Frederick Seidel's and do not necessarily represent the language and opinions of the editors of Poetry Magazine.
Here's Frederick Seidel reading Victory Parade.
My girlfriend is a miracle. She's so young, but she's so beautiful. So is her new bikini trim, a waxed to neatness center strip of quim. Now there's a word you haven't heard for a while. It makes me smile. It makes me think of James Joyce, You hear his Oirish voice. It's spring on Broadway, and in the center strip mall, the trees are all excited to be beginning. My girlfriend's amazing waxing keeps grinning. It's enough to distract from the other drastic act of display today. Osama bin Laden is dead. One shot to the chest and one to the head. SEAL Team 6, far away from my bed above Broadway, in Abbottabad, Pakistan, instead. Bullets beyond compare flew over there. Flew through the air to above and below the beard of hair. A type of ordnance that exploded inside the guy and instantly downloaded the brains out the nose. Our Vietnam is now radical Islam. I tip my hat and heart to the lovely tiny lampshade above her parade.
This seems like one of the poems that people would talk about when they talk about Seidel poems that offend. I mean, putting Osama bin Laden in a bikini wax in the same poem seems kind of outrageous, but I think it's wonderful. I think it's hilarious, and I don't feel the least bit offended.
Well, right, because it raises the question of, like, what's really offensive anyway?
Mm-hmm.
Is urbane alleged misogyny or our dispatching of villains in the violent way that we do, which is done in such a way that we get to continue our voluptuous lives without worrying too much about how these other things transpire.
SEAL Team 6, far away from my bed above Broadway, in Abbottabad, Pakistan, instead.
The way that his poems work is really that the rhymes are deadly bullets themselves. They're detonations.
Bullets beyond compare flew over there. Flew through the air to above and below the beard of hair, a type of ordnance that exploded inside the guy and instantly downloaded the brains out the nose.
It's not jokey. He's able to negotiate this so that things that seem cheap are meant to implicate the cheapness of the life that we embed ourselves in.
Mm-hmm.
A poem, especially the kind of poem that Seidel is so good at, is supposed to agitate and implicate us. And if we show any indignation, I think in this case it would be the poet who has the last laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear one more poem from Frederick Seidel. It's called What Next?
So the sun is shining blindingly, but I can sort of see. It's like looking at Mandela's moral beauty. The dying leaves are sizzling on the trees in a shirt sleeves summer breeze. But daylight saving is over, and gaveling the courtroom to order with a four-leaf clover is over, and it's all together in November, and the Pellegrino bubbles rise to the surface and dismember.
These poems make you want to start rhyming all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times you hear people say that contemporary poets have given up rhyme and they've ceded it to the rappers, and there's a lot of truth in that, but I think Seidel takes it all back. I think the rhymes are really extraordinary. Every one of them is a surprise. I mean, again, think of how hard it is if you're a poet and you have the word November, what are you going to rhyme it with?
Mm-hmm.
Dismember.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about the Pellegrino bubbles. There's something perfect and deadly about these poems.
Definitely.
A.E. Stalling's poems, translations, and essays have been appearing in poetry since the 1990s. Her latest book is a translation, On the Nature of Things, by Lucretius.
She is married to a Greek journalist, and they've been living in Greece since 1999.
Now, as you know from the news, Greece is going through a dire economic crisis. For the September issue, Alicia Stallings wrote a letter from Greece about how Greek poets are responding to the calamity. She joins us now by phone from Athens. Hi, Alicia.
Hello.
We have some questions for you. You know, Greece really has been in the news a lot. But what we get over here is the story of the crisis involving the euro And we don't hear so much about what's happening to ordinary Greeks. So can you give us a sense of how things are there? What are you seeing? What's it like?
Well, crisis seems the wrong word to me, because crisis suggests, you know, a critical moment in time, a moment of reckoning. This has been going on for, I don't know, 2.5 years maybe slightly longer. So it's more like a slow-moving train wreck with occasional bursts of drama. But you see a lot of increased poverty, people begging who aren't professional beggars, people sleeping on the streets. It's less noticeable in the summer, but in the winter, you would see people out there clearly with not enough clothes on and people looking for food in the dumpsters, things that you really wouldn't have seen several years ago. So it's quite visible. In the neighborhood, for instance, around the corner from us, there's a youngish fellow who has got evicted from his apartment, and he's living on the street with all of his belongings under a tarp, and neighbors are bringing him food. So it really is quite visible in Athens, maybe less so outside of Athens.
One has the impression that poetry often thrives in dire social circumstances. One example is the Polish poets of the 20th century. How are the Greek poets doing? How are they responding to this?
I think in general in the arts, there is a lot of energy, and I think the poetry is partaking of that. If you go into the neighborhood of Exarchia, which is a student-y neighborhood that's kind of famous for being the hangout of anarchists, and you would think this would be one of the sort of ground-down, impoverished areas. It's sort of known for its lawlessness. And it's often where riots start out and maybe finish. But if you go there in the evenings, there's a lot going on. Athens is covered in really vibrant graffiti, which perhaps isn't how you picture Athens. And people have taken over empty lots and making them into little parks just on their own. People are out playing music. There are homeless people and there are students out there. But in the evenings, you wouldn't get the sense that there is a crisis. It feels very vibrant. There are a lot of gallery openings. When you go to poetry events, they are very well attended. I think, well, maybe because also they tend to be free. I think, of course, modern Greek poetry is just full of Greek poets who've been through so much worse than the crisis. You hear everywhere, you know, if you're in the taxi or whatever, that it could be much worse. We're not at war. You know, the city isn't under a famine. So I think there is some resilience, even though there's also a lot of misery and suffering.
So you're married to a journalist. Do you think there's a difference between the way you and your husband have experienced this crisis or the vibrancy in the city that you talk about? Did you feel more like a journalist writing this piece, or did you still feel like a poet?
Well, it was kind of weird to be cast in the journalist mode, because I'm a poet and writer partly because I dread having conversations with strangers. Talking to people I don't know and going out. I mean, you know, I just want to sort of write in my little room. So I found that a little bit challenging. I tried to go out and about and see firsthand, you know, events that were happening and be more journalist-y. I guess the sense of being married to a journalist, there is a very different side to something like a crisis, because journalists descend upon the town when there's a riot going on. If there is a riot going on, the one thing I know is that my husband will be working. He will be out in it. We've been on things like, I have a friend that we have play dates with in the center of town, and, you know, the riot is gearing up, and I'm sort of in one building on the central square where all of this sort of street battles start out. And, you know, I can almost see my husband at one of the hotels where the journalists film from the balconies. You become a bit of a journalist widow during all of that. But.
Alicia, how do you feel that this situation in Greece has affected your own work? Has it inspired you or made things more difficult?
I would agree that it adds a certain urgency to things. I mean, to walk by the poverty and to realize, you know, there have been a couple of knife-edge decisions, whether Greece would suddenly leave the euro. And, I mean, there was a point where we had taken our money out of the bank and stashed it in the house. Not that, you know, there was a whole lot of it, but, and, you know, my husband was like, there could be a run on the banks, and my response was, you know, aren't we running on the bank? So I don't know whether it gives a certain urgency to things and to your writing. You don't really want to be writing something terribly flippant, I think, in the face of all of that, and maybe lends a sort of edge to your reading as well. But I wouldn't say I have this urge necessarily to write poems about the crisis, but things drift into the poems. I've had tear gas drift into poems. And I think that there's got to be some aspect of the level of external tension that has to affect you in some way.
You talk about meeting with some poets, and they agree, you say, that their calling is to speak to the human condition, to what is timeless rather than to current events. That is the job of journalists. It's the work of prose. Poetry needs distance. So do you sense a greater need for poetry among people in Greece just now?
It's interesting how poetry comes up. You see it, I mean, and perhaps it might be useful to make even a, you know, poetry verse distinction. There's a lot of poetry in certain classes of popular song in the sense that they really are very poetic in their expression, you know, rebetika and so forth, where these are songs from Asia Minor. They're a bit like the Greek blues. They're sort of cathartic about misery. And there's verse in the graffiti. Often that happens to come out in rather witty rhymed couplets. And even the political protests are chanted in verse. I mean, I've seen groups of youths, and I think they were perhaps Golden Dawn right-wing youths who were gearing up for some march or protest, but they were clearly trying to work out what their verses were going to be and make them stand so they would sound good going down the street. I think also there is this feeling that politicians have debased language and rhetoric, and there's a feeling that poetry perhaps is a bit of an antidote to that.
One last question. Are there a couple of lines of Greek poetry that have been floating around there that you can quote and translate for us? Is there something you've picked up?
You know, there are wonderful lines of Sepphoris that I think come out a lot. Everywhere I go, Greece wounds me. These sort of essential Greek expressions.
Is there any verse in Greek you can recite for us? That's okay.
Well, I can recite a proverb, which is in the air also.
Oh, that sounds good. What proverb is in the air?
Uthen moni motoron tu prosorinu. There is nothing more permanent than the temporary.
Well, that seems like a good place to leave it for now. Well, thank you so much, Alicia.
Thanks, Alicia.
Thank you very much.
You can read A.E. Stalling's essay and everything you heard on this program in the September 2012 issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox with help from Posey Gruner.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Lindsay Garbett.
And I'm Don Scher. Thanks for listening.